Welcome to the Political Cesspool, known worldwide as the South's foremost populist radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Welcome back to the second hour of tonight's live broadcast of the Political Cesspool radio program. I'm your host, James Edwards. The date is October 9th, Saturday evening, 2010. The Political Cesspool is going out to the AM-FM affiliate stations this evening of the Liberty News Radio Network. Of course, we're broadcasting as well from our flagship station in Memphis, Tennessee, AM 1380, WLRM, and to the Internet, where our simulcast can be found at thepoliticalcesspool.org. There, too, you'll find our broadcast archive available to you on demand 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, going all the way back to 2005, just a few months after we started this whole radio program, and immediately upon the conclusion of tonight's broadcast, you'll find the broadcast archive of this very show that you're listening to now. So many ways to get the information that we have for you here at TPC. And joining me this hour, first of all, I should mention that I want to thank Bill Rowland for co-hosting with me that first hour, and of course our guest during the first hour, Richard Spencer of Alternative Right. Always great to have Richard on the show. Now joining me this hour, everybody's favorite, the man who normally owns the first hour. The first hour is his, but tonight he's with us in the second hour. We like to keep you on the toes here, keep you on your toes. Keith Alexander. Keith, how are you?
Doing all right, man. How about you?
Doing well. I know you're on a business trip this evening. How's business?
It couldn't be better.
Booming.
Fine.
And yet still he finds the time to call in to our broadcast. That is the self-sacrifice personified by Keith Alexander. And Keith, I'm glad you could be with us tonight. I know you were a little bit tied up during that first hour, but better late than never. What do we want to talk about tonight, Keith? So much going on, so much up in the air tonight. I've got a couple of notes here, some things we'll make mention of perhaps later in the show, maybe even in the third hour, but while I have an opportunity to talk with my good friend, it's just so bizarre not being able to see him across the table from me at the studio in Memphis. So while we have him tonight, we'll let him pick. Keith, what do you want to talk about?
Well, we got a couple of things. We've got a local interest matter, which is the consolidation ballot battle that's coming up in Shelby County, or we can talk about something of more general interest, which would be what the future of America is in light of changing demographics. You take your pick, buddy.
I'm going to pick both great, mind you, both great topics. Let's go with door number two first. I'd love to talk demography.
Okay. Well, you know, the big demographic news has been that America's demographics are in the process of shifting, particularly with unlimited third world immigration being the rule rather than the exception in America. As I heard someone say one time, that not content to have one underclass in America, we now have two. We have Hispanic immigrants coming in to match the black underclass that we've had, you know, almost from the first days of obviously from the first days of our republic. And what effect is that going to have, coupled with the fact that according to UN demographers, America will no longer have a white majority population by the year 2042. They had previously said 2050, and the growth of the non-white population has been so great that they've now pared it back to 2042, and, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they readjusted that deadline date even closer to us sometime in the future. And what effect is that going to have on the America that we know and love, James?
Well, Keith, I would imagine that the minute that the day comes in which whites become a minority in this nation, that all of these great social welfare programs will begin to flow in our direction, don't you? Maybe not.
I doubt that. I seriously
Maybe not.
Doubt that. What I think is going to happen, you know, there is a inordinate interest in today's America in apocalyptic visions. If you don't believe me, just tune in the History Channel someday and find out what they're putting on the airwaves.
Oh, yeah, the great Mayans, those Mayans of infinite wisdom who believed if you just pulled out enough hearts or decapitated enough slaves that it would make it rain. They couldn't foretell their own demise at the hands of the Spaniards, but by God, they know when the world's going to end for the rest of us. Right, Keith?
Yeah, apparently so. That's one of the scenarios that you always see on the History Channel, something about the Mayan calendar and the ominous fact that it does not go beyond December the 21st of the year 2012. And, of course, there are all the doom and gloom people that say that's going to be the end of the world, and they make History Channel programs based on that.
Hey, Keith, I don't mean to interrupt, but I do want to interject because this is an interesting topic. When you came over for one of the lunches that we have each week during which we outline the topics for the forthcoming Saturday evening show, I asked you about that. I said, you know, how could so many people put stock in what a bunch of savages thought when the world was going to end? And you mentioned about how, you know, all of these cultures are interchangeable in their eyes, and the Mayans were just as advanced as we are.
That's what they call Boasian anthropology. That was the contribution or the catastrophe, depending on your viewpoint, of Franz Boas, who was a European Jew who became a famous anthropologist in the United States, and he was the mentor of people like Margaret Mead, and his contribution is that anthropology is a study of cultures, various cultures throughout the world. His contribution was that all cultures are equal. He was a grand egalitarian, and quite frankly, the more primitive the culture, the more we as sophisticated Westerners have to learn from it. They're not only equal, their culture is not only equal to ours, but superior. So consequently, any good Boasian anthropologist would love to see great and subtle wisdom in something like the Mayan culture. And that's what all of these studies of the Mayan calendar, for example, are based on, that basic underlying Boasian approach to anthropology in different cultures.
You know, it's going to be interesting, Keith. On December 22nd, when we all wake up and the world's still spinning on its axis, they'll just brush all that under the rug. You know, so much hype and so much hoopla has been invested in the great wisdom of the ancient Mayans and their great prophecy, and, you know, so many books have been sold, and so many History Channel hours have been devoted to it. And when December 22nd comes, it'll be as if, you know, that never happened, and they'll just go on to the next example of cultural egalitarianism, and we'll just be told to forget about that one.
It's like Gilda Radner on her old Saturday Night Live skit where she says, oh, never mind, you know, and we just move on. but there are, it will bring to a crashing halt the cottage industry of a few so-called experts, I'm put that in quotation marks, that have made a cottage industry out of pontificating about this. But
they better cash in on it. Well, they got about 14 more months, I guess, to cash in, and then they're going to have to find a new job. Maybe the Aztecs had a similar calendar. Hey, Keith, I hear our music. Stay tuned, buddy. We're going to pick up on this thread when we continue here on the Political Cesspool Radio program.
Don't go away. There's more Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages. Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, everybody. Got a lot more forthcoming during tonight's third hour. We're going to be talking about some racist political ads that are being aired in Nevada. In other words, a conservative actually was able to televise an ad in Nevada. If you read between the lines, that's really what the headline says. American Renaissance has just penned a very glowing review of my book, Racism Schmacism. We'll talk about that in the third hour and more. There's even a lawsuit going on out there that we're very much in favor of. All that forthcoming tonight during the Political Cesspool's third hour. But first, continuing on with Keith Alexander, among other things in that previous segment, Keith, we were talking about the infinite wisdom of the ancient Mayans and how they knew the world was going to end in 2012. They just couldn't quite figure out what was going to happen to them when the Europeans hit South America.
Well, you know, we're talking about apocalyptic visions, or I guess another word for it would be end times theorizing, which seems to be a very popular pastime in popular culture in America now, and I'm sure in Europe as well. Another secularist type of theorizing involves the prophecies of Nostradamus. And, of course, Christians have the Book of Revelations, and the History Channel is replete with stories about how the prophecies of the Book of Revelation are working themselves out and coming up with parallels with actual historical events that have already occurred, yada, yada, yada. But everybody seems to be ignoring the quite obvious catastrophe that is fast approaching America because of demographic change. And what I would predict is this: as America becomes less and less white and more non-white, what you're going to see happen is there's going to be more and more slums, little bits of the third world in America. If you live in a neighborhood or a city that has a substantial non-white population, you're already familiar with what the face of the future is going to look like when you go to those slums that inevitably rise up in cities that have a substantial non-white population. You're going to see more and more of those slums, more and more of America, more and more of the American landscape is going to look and be, in effect, third world. And when that happens, you're going to see that there's going to be a drop in the productivity, drop in the average IQ, and America will eventually descend into being a legitimate, bona fide third world nation, James.
Well, Keith, you know, I couldn't agree more. So Keith Alexander's own apocalyptic vision here, although this one is rooted in common sense and in conventional wisdom, the fact that if you really want to know when the world is going to come to an end, you can directly correlate that to demographic trends. Keith, is that basically what you're saying here?
Yeah, it may not be that type of end, but you're going to see a breakdown in life as we know it in America, and it's going to be more like life in Haiti or life in Mexico.
The bridges will cave in, the airplanes won't be able to take off the ground, surgery. You know, this might be somewhat of an embellishment or an exaggeration, but truly, you know, as we've always said, Keith, I mean, you gave me this line, and I took it to CNN and beyond, you can't have a first-world nation with a third-world population, and as America begins to more and more resemble a third-world population, you will see all of the advantages of the first world, a.k.a. the Western world, the white world. You will see many of these things slowly
dissolve,
but surely.
Right,
we've already seen it. Look at Detroit, Michigan. I mean, you don't have to look far to see this manifesting itself in cities and in areas where the demographics aren't favorable to Western civilization.
Well, you know, we were talking about this. We were talking about the bombing of Dresden by the Allies, Dresden, Germany, during World War II, and how horrendous that was, how 135,000 souls perished in a deliberate assault, really a war crime against civilians, by firebombing the city. But, you know, the irony
of course, the American precedent was set there with General Sherman. They just decided to continue
That was where war crimes against civilians kind of had their genesis in America.
Right.
But if you look at Detroit today, which during World War II was the pride of American industrial might,
right,
and compare today's Detroit with today's Dresden, Germany, you would assume that the Germans won the war, wouldn't you, James?
Keith, that is exactly right. I couldn't have put it better myself. I've compared and contrasted those two cities similarly, but I think you found the exact wording that should be used, and it couldn't be more true. I mean, if you took a snapshot, if you went back to 1942, 1943, at the height of World War II, and you knew that America was engaged or about to become engaged in this war, and you knew it was about to come to pass, and then you say, okay, let's fast forward to the year 2010, and you take a snapshot of Dresden, and you take a snapshot of Detroit, you're going to be like, well, it looks like Adolf got us, guys. You know, they won.
Yeah, it's really crazy. There's, you know, we've talked about this before, and it's a hard truth, but it's one that people need to really lock onto because it is the truth and it is your future. You know, it's like Trotsky said, you may not be interested in the revolution, but the revolution is interested in you. Well, there's a parasite-host relationship, unfortunately, between, let's say, the black population and the white population in America, and of course, the non-white population in other parts of the world, and like Europe, and the white population there. It's like, don't kill the dog or all the fleas will die. Well, whites being the dogs, okay, or the dog. And basically, black people or non-white people need to live in the midst of a lot of white people in order to live in a first world environment. And when what is going to happen as fewer and fewer white people are available? And furthermore, all the advantages we associate with white people are being diminished daily through the application of draconian affirmative action laws and hate crime laws and things like this. There's going to be, you know, you can run, but you can't hide. There's not going to be enough people to sustain it, and you're going to see the decline that is inevitable that we all see around us. If you live in an area that has a large non-white population, you know, be careful what you wish for. Your dream may come true. When blacks gain control of a city, the city diminishes, and if enough white people leave, it becomes Detroit or Gary, Indiana, Camden, New Jersey, East St. Louis, Illinois. And look closely at those places, James, because that is going to be the future of America unless this demographic trend reverses itself very suddenly and very quickly, because you know, demographic trends and cultures are like aircraft carriers. You can't turn them around on a dime. And you know, when the whites leave, civilization leaves shortly thereafter. At least that's my observation.
Well, and I'd like to explore that a little bit further, Keith. You know, I made an appearance on the Jeff Rentz show a couple of weeks ago. It has a very large audience, very knowledgeable audience, and I compared and contrasted Haiti with France, and this is a discussion that you and I have also had in the past. I'd like to explore that a little bit further when we get into the next segment. I know that we don't have a lot of time left in this segment, so we'll do it after the commercial break. But, you know, you're exactly right, Keith, in talking about these demographic trends.
See, and people have this idea through the neocons and whatnot that we're a creedal nation and all that the people and the race of the people is totally interchangeable. All you have to do is ascribe to the principles of the founding fathers, and you will have a wonderful, thriving nation, and it will continue, and there will be no difference, regardless of who the majority of the citizens are.
Well, yeah, that's certainly the argument that the liberals would have. Of course, anyone with any sense has never bought into the creedal argument. I mean, we're a nation of blood and soil, just like every other nation. In fact, that's what the definition of a nation is. It has root in peoplehood. Whereas a country is just a geographic location on a map, a nation is a specific ethnostate. Stay tuned, everybody. We'll be back.
To get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool, call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
Welcome back, everybody. James Edwards, Keith Alexander, hosting with you this second hour of the Political Cesspool radio program, Saturday evening, October 9th. Little dysfunctional installment of the festival, not in terms of quality, of course, but still bringing you the kind of precision commentary that you're always expecting, but it's just with everyone on the road and in different locations, it's just logistically speaking, it's a little bit different for us. But I don't get you to see that behind-the-scenes stuff. At least you haven't seen it yet. You're about to with the Political Festival video project, which is being launched and will debut this week, so stay tuned to the website for more information about that. ThePoliticalCesspool.org. We're going to give you great updates. We'll show you what it's like inside the studio.
I wouldn't wear it home, of course. We couldn't do it tonight. But all that forthcoming, we're really excited about that. Now, Keith, you and I were talking about demographic trends and how the advanced...
How it doesn't bode well for the future of America.
Yeah, in this world, you know, the first world countries all have one thing in common, Keith, and what is that?
They are white nations, for the most
period.
Part. We have some non-white first world nations, like Japan, for example, or Dubai. But they are the exception rather than the rule. The rule is that most first world nations are majority white nations.
And you made a comment in the previous segment that said when you have first world societies, even when you have a first world nation, that nation only maintains its first world identity so long as the white people are there to lead it. And a great case study on this, I made mention of this on the Rents program. I told people we would talk about this before the last commercial break. I made mention of this on the Rents program. You and I have talked about it in private, Keith. Share with the audience. I don't know if we've actually made this example on the political festival before, but we'll do it tonight. Compare and contrast Haiti and France, Keith, and how that further proves our point that even in countries that were once first world or would be described as first world, they only exist as first world countries so long as the ruling population is of European stock. How does Haiti prove that rule?
Well, that's been the experience so far, and Haiti is a perfect example. Haiti, when it used to be a French colony, was called the Jewel of the Caribbean. It had the wealthiest plantations. It was the most prosperous part of the New World, bar none. But then, you know, again, I said, be careful what you wish for. Your dream may come true. The black slaves had a revolt led by Toussaint Louverture in 1802 to 1803, in which they either drove out or killed all the white inhabitants, even the mulatto inhabitants, even the half-white people. And ever since then, Haiti has been synonymous with poverty, superstition, immorality, incompetence, corruption, every negative that you can think of. That's what Haiti is. And quite frankly, the nation couldn't exist if it were not for foreign aid primarily from white nations.
Well, Keith,
another point you made
that I thought was just absolutely excellent. This goes back to, I tell you, the political festival is such a treasure. There's no other radio program that's going to bring you the unadulterated truth in the way that we do. We are one of a kind. I guess that's why we're so famous. And I don't say that braggadociously, but the reason we've been able to attain such a reputation and such media publicity is because we're so unique. And we were talking about the creedal argument versus the blood and soil argument. I believe that a nation is defined by its people. Liberals believe a nation is defined by its ideas, and that the success of any nation it hinges upon the ideas that it advances rather than the genetic makeup. And Keith, Haiti proves our point on this, that it's not a creed that contributes to the success of a nation. It is the people. And how does Haiti do that? Because Haiti had many of the same governmental and judicial systems as France. Keith, your thoughts on that? Because
Haiti to this day still has a French governmental system, a French legal system, and speaks the French language, but nobody mistakes Haiti for France. And the reason for that is that, you know, the creedal nation thing is kind of a halfway house. Real leftists think that the American creed, for example, or the principles of government are a bunch of baloney. Now, neocons, people like Charles Krauthammer, Jonah Goldberg, whatnot, they're the primary exponents of this creedal idea, which says that the racial stock of a nation doesn't count, particularly America, as long as we still have the same institutions, everything will move along seamlessly. But we keep having these pesky real-life examples like Detroit, Michigan, Gary, Indiana, East St. Louis, Illinois, Camden, New Jersey, popping up like a loose board on the porch, slapping us in the face, telling us that it ain't necessarily so, as they said in the musical Porgy and Bess. you're just not going to have that. That is a practical experience. And, you know, that what so consequently what demographic change means is that we are facing a future in which more and more of our cities and localities are going to descend into virtual third world status, and we're going to become more like Haiti unless we can do something about preserving the predominance of white people in the United States and Europe.
Well, Keith, you know, the case study of Haiti versus France is one on a national level, but I mean, you can even pare this down to city by city. I mean, why, you know, Detroit being an obvious example, why does Detroit look like a bombed out shell, where in this very same country you have, you know, white
Provo, people. Utah, for example.
Yeah, Provo, Utah, very, very clean, very orderly. It runs like a Swiss watch. And this is the same country. You know, it's all America. So what's the difference? You know, we all have the same creed here. We're all Americans. What's the difference between Detroit and Provo or Detroit and New Orleans?
Well, it's obviously the people in Detroit versus Provo. And see, that's where the problem is, James. It's that. Go ahead.
But what I was going to say is, you know, these ideas, I think Sam Dixon was on the show once to talk about Abraham Lincoln, and he was sharing, you know, some ideas and thoughts about Lincoln. And what he said in that conversation can really be used in almost any commentary that we bring to the audience's attention on the political cesspool. These ideas are so readily apparent. These ideas are rooted in such basic common sense that it's amazing to me, Keith, that anyone can argue otherwise. It's amazing to me that there's even two sides to this argument that the conversation that we're having right now, that there could even be an argument. You know, what's the difference between Detroit and Provo? What's the difference between Haiti and France? Well, there is only one. There's only one.
And you see, less and less of the United States is going to be like Provo, and more is going to be like Detroit.
Because of immigration. I mean, the people that are immigrating to America don't come from Sweden.
And they're not from a first world background, and they have a parasitic presence, and they cannot duplicate the society and the culture that we have in America, nor the prosperity. And, you know, added to that is the fact that we have a leadership that is sold out, lock, stock, and barrel, mentally and emotionally, to the idea of one world government. And of course, one world government's great goal from the days of the Fabian Society onward was equalizing incomes worldwide. Well, if we get equalized in America, we are going to have a tremendous drop in our gross per capita income. And that apparently is something that doesn't alarm our elites, but it should alarm every American, because, you know, that roar you hear is Niagara Falls, and we as a nation are about to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel when we're losing what is left of our manufacturing base. We're selling capital assets to try to sustain current levels of consumer spending. And any kid that plays Monopoly knows how that type of theory or that strategy winds up. If you have to sell off all your hotels and houses in order to go around the board, you're not going to be going around the board very many more times, are you, James?
Keith, that is another excellent analogy I might have to hijack. But you know, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, and I know when you're a media personality, you're not supposed to revisit something you've already said previously in the same commentary, but I just can't get off the Detroit comparison. I mean, it totally debunks the whole myth that this is a creedal nation and that it's our creed that makes us Americans. Well, that's baloney.
Well, every nation, like you said, is a blood and soil nation in final analysis. The idea of a creedal nation is, quite frankly, flapdoodle. It is somebody's pipe dream.
There are some ideas that have been instrumental in the development of America, but these ideas came from the minds of those of European stock. I mean, there are no
and they don't seem to work when you don't have European stock. For example, jury trial are a perfect example.
Hang on one second. Let's talk about jury trial when we get back. I'll be interested to see where that goes. Stay tuned, everybody.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
What a remarkable broadcast we have here at the Political Festival. How honored I am to be your host. You know, in the last 45 minutes, Keith Alexander and I have single-handedly, as a duo, debunked the whole Creedal Nation myth. You know, if everyone was tuned into the show tonight, there'd never be another discussion about it, Keith, right?
Well, they're being armed with counter-arguments for
anything,
people.
But I think you've done a pretty dead-gum convincing job of just really noticing the obvious and putting it into words. I mean, that's all we do here.
Well, we're giving people arguments or counter-arguments to make when they encounter liberals or these mainstream conservatives that want to tell you that race is unimportant. You know, it was, I think, Ashley Montague, whose real name is Israel Ehrenreich, who wrote a book back in the 40s called Race, Mankind's Most Dangerous Myth. Well, it's mankind's most dangerous reality, possibly. It certainly isn't a myth. And the Creedal Nation notion that we were talking about would apply to things like a jury trial. A jury trial should, as a principle, apply and work just as well, regardless of the racial makeup of the population. But that hasn't happened. If you are a follower of contemporary politics and you've heard about a movement called tort reform, which is basically aimed at cutting away or cutting back and eventually eliminating people's rights to get a jury trial in a civil as opposed to a criminal trial. And the reason they do this is because they complain about runaway juries. For example, the Medical Association, American Medical Association, and Republicans say that, you know, the way to get medical costs down is to do away with jury trials or to cut back on the authority of a jury to award damages. They are fighting what they call runaway juries. I think that John Grisham even wrote a novel by that name, where people, for example, give you $1 million for spilling hot coffee on yourself at McDonald's. But the dirty little secret about runaway juries is that runaway juries don't happen everywhere. The vast majority of runaway jury verdicts happen in venues that are majority-minority. In other words, have a majority of black jurors or majority of Hispanic jurors. If you're in a place like Provo, Utah, I've never heard of any complaints about runaway juries. But, of course, the Republican Party and mainstream conservatives and liberals will never tell you that information. They'll keep that hidden away because that undercuts this idea that, you know, people are interchangeable and that the racial makeup of a jury has nothing to do with the type of jury verdict that they're going to reach, James. But, you know, again, that's just one example. See, a jury trial is a very important part of our cultural heritage. The Founding Fathers thought so much of it that they preserved our right to jury in the Bill of Rights as something that we should have, and we're being exhorted to give it away. In other words, because blacks and Hispanics can't behave properly on juries, they're going to deny the benefits of a jury trial to everyone, including the majority of white Americans who seem to have no problem at all in behaving in the jury room.
Well, it's just another example of Western civilization in action. I think a lot of Americans take for granted that we have all of these, I don't know if you want to call them luxuries, I mean, But in the sense they are, you know,
well, they're part of our racial heritage.
In third world nations, you don't have the right to freedom of speech. You know, you barely have it here now, but because
you don't have the right to a jury, and if you don't have a right to a jury, for example, in Europe, where the judge doesn't intrude into the jury room and tell the jury what they're supposed to think and what they're supposed to do, the separation between the jury and the judge is sacrosanct in the United States and in Britain, but not so elsewhere. And as you can see, you know, it's just too much of a temptation, apparently, for non-white people to have someone else's checkbook in their hands and to write out checks to other people, particularly if they are racial kinsmen of themselves, in jury trials, in civil cases, and that's why you get results like the million-dollar verdict for spilling hot coffee on yourself at McDonald's that was so highly publicized a few years ago.
All of these years we've been struggling to fund the radio program. I mean, thankfully we have a great and supportive listening audience who keeps the wheels on the wagon here, but, you know, selling books, going out and sending out donation letters, that's we've been doing it all wrong. We just need to go to McDonald's and spill coffee in our lap.
But see, this is a problem, though. See, our founding fathers thought that a jury trial was so important that they actually addressed it and provided that it is protected against any type of legislative change in the Bill of Rights, at least on the federal level. And we're being told to give it away, but our elite handlers aren't being honest with us. They're not telling us what the problem is, and like so many other things in America today, when you get right down to it, it's a problem of race more than anything else, James.
Well, Keith, we see it every day, but this is the thing. You know, so many people see what we're saying. What we're saying is it's fundamentally sound. It's common sense.
We're trying not to think that way.
Well, they're trained not to think that way, but they still see it. I mean,
Well, they've done a good job of training us because, quite frankly, the fact that we're having to bring this to people's attention, and I'm sure it's going to be a revelation to a lot of people out there, particularly a lot of these so-called mainstream conservatives that think that, oh, yeah, tort reform, yeah, get those damn trial lawyers and this, that, and the other. Well, let me tell you, these trial lawyers and the right to a trial by jury was important to George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and people like that. And it was important to them for a reason. They were much wiser, quite frankly, than the people that are governing America now. And they would have recognized immediately that, you know, the problems that we're having today are racial problems. But we're conditioned to think that race makes no difference whatsoever, and, of course, that's the biggest fallacy of them all.
Well, we're the only people that are trained to think that way. Jews certainly don't think that way. That's why they administer an apartheid
state. Blacks don't think that way. Hispanics don't think that way. Orientals don't think that way.
No one thinks that way except for our people, and our people wouldn't think that way. But, there's a whole other can of worms as to why we go along with this, even though we know it to be untrue. Not we here in the cesspool or our audience, but white people in general. They know that they've got to recite these lies in order to be publicly accepted, but in their heart of hearts, you know, this is the emperor who has no clothes all over again. But I guess we've talked about that enough over the course of the last 6 years. We'll continue to talk about it. Time doesn't permit us to open that can of worms in this segment, although, Keith, not to get off topic, and this has been such a riveting conversation this hour, but you mentioned, you invoked the Founding Fathers a second ago. I want to direct people to our blog. You want to know why a lot of white people don't think right? Well, go to thepoliticalcesspool.org and just read what is being passed off as curriculum in some of these schools. Flocabulary. Keith, did you read that blog?
Yeah, that was incredible that they've come up with something. That they keep trying to close this so-called achievement gap between blacks and whites, and nothing seems to do the trick. The more they spend, they're spending obscene amounts of money to do this. We have No Child Left Behind. We have the Race to the Top under Obama. We had No Child Left Behind under Bush. Both parties have drunk the same Kool-Aid, and it's because they're unwilling to confront the reality of racial differences. You know, there have been studies done that show that poor white kids score better on standardized tests than rich black kids. So there goes out the window the argument that it has to do with family background or wealth or culture and things like this. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with race. And we're not saying that, you know, everybody needs to get an education that is best suited to them. When I was a kid coming up, you know, there was such an idea as college material. Everybody was not considered college material. Some people went to technical schools, both white and black. But today in the city of Memphis, they have a billboard campaign that says, every child, every day, college bound. That's like saying that we live in Memphis, it's the same as Lake Wobegon, you know, where all the kids are above average. Well, you know, that ain't so. And, you know, the more that we keep trying to live in some alternative universe where this wishful thinking prevails over reality, you know, is it any wonder that, you know, government can't seem to do the most elementary functions that they have done before? You know, we were talking about this one time. They had a display case in the Memphis courthouse, and in it, it was about segregation in the law, and it had a picture of two black activists back in the 60s with a sign that said, "Segregated education - inferior and expensive." And I said, that would probably qualify as one of the biggest lies of all time, because it's integrated education that is both, one, inferior, and two, expensive. And the results of the Memphis City schools now compared to 1954 are the perfect, you know, rejoinder to that type of argument.
Well, Keith, you know, people should be reminded that there is a third and final hour forthcoming right around the corner. But our time with you is up, and I tell you, you made good use of every minute. I know you've been on an exhaustive business trip this week, and you need to retire for the evening. But I want to thank you for calling in from the road to give to us your talents tonight, and I'll see you when you get back home.
Okay, you have a great time.
You too, buddy. And for everyone else, don't go anywhere. I'm coming right back.